So, welcome everyone to our third class in our series, Five More 20th Century Houses. Today we'll be dealing with Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright. Most of you are probably familiar with this house, being so close to us here in Pittsburgh. This house was from 1935. To 1938. And before we get into discussing Wright's house, I wanted to just briefly touch on the house that we looked at last week, Villa Savoy. Let me see if I can get my slides here. And this is by Le Corbusier, if you recall back from last week's lecture. Considered to be the pinnacle of modern architecture in the 20th century, in particular the long horizontal ribbon window that we're seeing here on the facade, which is also considered to be the most significant window in 20th century architecture. In addition to that, the week before, we took a look at the Schroeder House by Gerrit Rietveld. This was 1925. Which was also influenced by, to some degree, by Frank Lloyd Wright. We'll get into a little bit to that here today. But to start off, I wanted to see if we could put together a poll. Let's see if I can pull it up here. Just one moment. Question on this poll is, which house, Le Corbusier's Villa Savoy or Gerrit Rietveld's Schroeder House, would you consider more modern in the design and expression of the architect's vision of the modern age? So if you want to take a moment, we'll weigh in on this. I'm curious to find out. Of the two houses from the last 2 weeks, which one you might have felt expresses, again, the modern age more so. And while you're weighing in on here, I'll also mention a reminder that we have Aaron O'Neill helping us out today as my co-host. If you have any questions, feel free to put them in on chat. He'll try to field those as we go along. The ones he can't, he'll pass along to me. We can take them. And as well as he'll also put some additional information in the chat feature as well if you're interested in following along with that. So it looks like most everyone here has weighed in on this. So we'll wrap it up here and move along. Looks like the results we have, Le Corbusier won out with 57% of the vote. And not surprising, as I mentioned at the top, that Villa Savoy is considered to be one of the high marks of the modern era, mid-century. So with that, we'll get right into Wright. The speaking of Falling Water today, we really have to go back to the Robey House that we're seeing here on screen. 1909, if you recall back. We briefly touched on this in the first lecture, but some of you that had taken the previous course, this was one of the five houses at the start of the century that we covered. And this house in Chicago was really the high mark of Wright's prairie style house. But in particular, in addition to this prairie style that he became very well known for, it's significant for today's lecture because it's one of two houses that really influenced Falling Water, and we'll see that as we go along. But I'll point out just a couple elements here in this image here. You can see, again, these broad overhangs with the roof line, creating a very strong shadow line from the large overhangs. Just the horizontality that's expressed here, kind of mimicking the ground plane by these continuous lines from the roof line that's uninterrupted, as well as below that, you can see the balcony coming off the main level. The terrace has stonework, and the brickwork is continuously uninterrupted, creating this strong horizontal. But also in particular, the French doors that come out of the main living level here, the stained glass doors that create this band, horizontal banding, continuous window that we saw in Corbusier's Villa Savoy. We see here in Wright preceding it with his continuous doors in a series here that let the light flood in to this space. If we go move on to the floor plan, we can see this series of doors here at the bottom. But then the interior is laid out in the same linear fashion, continuous open space, the main living room flowing into the dining room here on the right. This kind of elongation of the plan in this linear axis is really significant in trying to create this continuous open space, the open floor plan that he became known for. But then also, if we go back to the exterior, down to the corner and take a look at the house from this three-quarter view, you get this classic image of the long cantilevering roof plane that we see here, where it extends out at the end of this, and this idea of the long linear horizontal that is extending out, that the cantilevering roof accentuates that and creates this idea that the house is continuing in this axial way to infinity. And so much the same way that he used the cantilever here in the Robey house, we see with Falling Water, we see the same cantilevering, even in the roof plane here up at the top right, where he's again sending that out to accentuate this horizontality that's continuing off metaphorically into space. We also see the same three-quarter view here as we approach the house, where we're getting the house from the two sides, just becoming much more dynamic because we can see the depth and the width simultaneously. But it's this cantilevering, really, it's one of the hallmarks of Wright's work, not only in the early prairie style, but also here in the Falling Water much later, but much more significant to the makeup of this house. And that's really one of the primary things we're going to get in here to today, is why the cantilever was significant in Falling Water. In addition to that, though, as I mentioned, there's really two houses that strongly influenced Falling Water. This is the second one here. This is the Laura Gale house that he designed in 1909. So it was the same year that he designed the Robey house. And you can see here in this illustration of the Gale house, this same strong horizontal flat roof line that's extending out and creating the large overhangs, the eaves, but in this case cantilevering out not as much, but still to an effect. But more significantly with this house is the the balcony in on the second floor here, as well as the terrace here on the first floor, protruding out towards us here on the right, the side of the house protruding out as well. In fact, it comes out on all sides. And this, if you recall back to our lecture last week with Corbusier, some of you might recall the Froebel blocks that were influencing Le Corbusier's development as a child. The same thing was the case with Frank Lloyd Wright. He was raised as a young child with these gifts or these block assemblies that were used by his parents, his mother in particular, to teach him this concept that Frederick Froebel was pushing at the time, related to the spatial development of the child. And so this stacking of blocks in a particular way, as well as just the manipulation of the blocks, hand and eye, was significant. And we see how that development carries through in the Gale house. You can see very much this block type assembly in the form, in the massing of that house. I'll also point out here the windows on the upper level, the main living level here. You can see the banding again of the windows, and also not only this kind of ribbon banding that we saw with Corbusier, but also you see the windows here coming right to the corner, this corner window element, also to be found, we'll see, in Falling Water. Also, in 1909, at the time that these two houses were designed by Wright, we also see, this is the same year that Brock, one of his paintings that we're seeing on screen here, as well as Picasso, were both working on kind of the early development of cubism, this abstraction in painting. We're trying to take, as we can see here with Picasso's painting, you take this form, in this case, this building here, and view it from two sides simultaneously. So it's this three-quarter view that we're familiar with in the way that Wright's buildings have been photographed that enable you to see two sides of the building simultaneously. And this kind of simultaneous views is really kind of one of the key tenets of the Cubist movement. And so this same year that that these painters were developing or starting to develop this Cubism movement, Wright was doing a similar thing in his architecture. We take even further, we're looking here at a building by an architect in a Dutch architect by the name of Robert van 't Hoff. This is a concrete house that made of concrete in 1916 in Utrecht. And this, as you can see, also a similar form to the Gale house. And this is not coincidental. Hoff was familiar with Wright, actually met with Wright at one point when Wright was over in Europe, publishing his works. The 1909 Robey House and Gale House were both part of his publication. He came across van 't Hoff, who was taken by his designs and his works that he was doing, and in particular this Gale House, where this, again, this volume and massing had an appeal in this very dynamic, modern, early kind of predecessor to the moderns. This was then a few years later in 1923, the painter Theo van Doesburg over here on the left, as well as also another architect of the De Stijl movement, Cornelius van Easterlin, and his model here on the right, a three-dimensional model. The two of these worked together for submission to the Paris exhibition in 1923, where they submitted these paintings and model for these abstracted three-dimensional forms. And so we see Very much like Van Hoff's concrete house in Utrecht. We see them also exploring with this same cubist volumetric block type form. But in particular, now they've taken it even further where they're abstracting the box and they're pulling the planes apart and identifying them, much like if you recall back where we saw with Rietveld's house, the Schroeder house, colorizing the planes to differentiate them, but also as in the painting in the model here, the three-quarter view taking in the sides simultaneously. This then takes us to the same year, later that year, 1923, after the Paris exhibition. Gerrit Rietveld did then design and built the Schroeder House, and he was familiar with this Paris exhibition. He was an associate of Theo van Doesburg and the Distill architects and of this group, and so he was trying to take these ideas and model and painting form the exhibition and develop it into a built work, which we covered in the first lecture of this series. And so here, in the Schroeder House, he's taken it even further to where these planes that he's differentiating on sides as well as on top in the roof plane, he's pulling them apart. He's essentially deconstructing the box, so to speak, or these blocks, Froebel blocks that were volumetric and stacked. Here he still has these blocks stacked, creating this form, but then he's also taking the planes and the surfaces of these blocks and he's deconstructing them, pulling them apart. And it's this idea of deconstructing the box or in Wright's terms, destroying the box was something that was that Wright was trying to do as well in his own work. And so this Gale House that we saw that influenced these European painters and architects through these works through the 1923 that we then have Wright taking it to the next step with Falling Water, where he's going to take and deconstruct this box even further with the pulling the walls and the roof planes apart. Just a real quick side note here that you might find of interest. This architect Van Hoft from Utrecht that was big fan of Wright's work, he continued to stay in touch with Wright once Wright returned back to the States. He would continue to send him publications from Europe of the work that was happening, such as the Paris exhibition. And so Wright, even though he was back in the States and he was not in connection with these works that were going on personally, we are aware that he was familiar with these works by the literature that was being sent to him or continued to be sent to him by Van Hoff all the way through the 1920s. So that would have included this Schroeder House in particular. So getting back to Falling Water, 1935, Wright was given this commission by Kaufman, Edgar Kaufman, to build this summer weekend house to get away from the city in Pittsburgh where they lived and worked. And they would go out to this this property, in particular to this creek. That ran through the property, Bear Run was the name of the stream. And this particular location that we're seeing here in the photograph was one of their favorite spots, this waterfall here. You can see the rock coming out from the hillside, creating the waterfall or creating the drop in the stream. Up on top of this rock was one of their favorite spots to sit and picnic. When they would go out for the weekends to get away from the city. And so in 1935, when Wright was given this commission, he went out to the site, multiple times to take a look at the site and try to study it and figure the best way to build a house on the site. And one particular visit in July 3rd, 1935, he was out there with a couple of his apprentices, and he made the comment standing in this spot here, pointing up to the waterfall into the rock outcrops. And he said, "We're going to beat the internationalists at their own game." And so here he was making reference to these architects and painters back in Europe that were copying his work or developing his work. He wanted to then take and push his work as well as even their work further and beat them at their own game. And so there was a little bit of a camaraderie competition between Wright back in the States and the Europeans through the early and mid-century. And also significantly, of note, from 1928 through 1935, up until the year that he received this commission, was a slow period for Wright. During that time period, he only had two projects that were under construction. But then in 35, in that year, he received three commissions at once, Falling Water, the Johnson Administration Building that you may be familiar with, as well as the Jacob House, which is also a significant house that we're going to take a look at in the next series of five houses following this course. But interesting enough is the fact that going through this period of time where his business was slow, but then given three major significant commissions all at once, as you can imagine, must have excited him, got him very motivated to want to create some of his best work. And in fact, those three particular commissions are some of his best work. And so it's not surprising. But we're seeing here in this image a cabin that was on the property at the time that the Kaufmans would use to stay in when they'd come out for the weekend. And affectionately, the nickname that they referred to this cabin was the Hangover. And I think that the term or the nickname came from the fact that, as you can see here, it was built right up close to the edge of the hillside here, up on stilts. And so the house had this feel, especially from the upper balcony to, I imagine, where you feel like you're hanging out over the side of the hill. You can see also the rock croppings down here. And also significantly, you can see a bridge here that's going across the stream. And so this is actually the same vantage point or the entry point for Falling Water coming across the bridge down around the turn here with the outcrops here on the right-hand side. And so significantly, Wright located the house not too far from this temporary or this house that was on site at the time that they had used. In fact, Wright was quoted to say, "There is a beautiful forest. There in a beautiful forest was a solid high rock ledge rising beside a waterfall. And the natural thing seemed to be to cantilever the house from that rock bank over the waterfall. The site determined the character and the features of the house." And so here we see not only this cabin that they were using sitting up on top of the hill, overlooking the stream, clearly put the idea in Wright's head as far as locating the house in a similar fashion up on the hillside, overlooking the stream. But he took it even further to where he would cantilever the house out over the stream. This Hangover nickname that was given, I imagine, put also this seed in his mind as well, as far as hanging out over the stream. And so, in fact, here we see a model of Falling Water, and we see really this partie that he has now kind of developed in his mind of how he's going to locate this house. We see down here below on the right-hand side, the stream that's running underneath the house that's jetting out atop of it. But more significantly, the parterre is this this main living level here. We see the long horizontal line that we saw in the Roby house at the start of the lecture here today. We see that carrying through on the main living level. This long linear line, the same way in the Roby house that continues out with the cantilevering at the two ends, is happening here in Falling Water. He's got, you can see the glass doors and windows that open out to this long axis, so that from inside you have this continuous view in this axial direction. But also significantly, he has this long horizontal running parallel to the direction of the stream below it. So he's almost mimicking the stream down below with this horizontal line. And then he takes the Roby house here on the main level, and then he tops it with the second and the third level, the bedroom suites, with the Gale house. And so here we see the forms of the Gale house block, the center massing of Falling Water, but in particular, the balcony, if you recall back from the Gale house, that was protruding out in the four directions. We see that on this second level here, these terraces coming out and extending out beyond the Roby house below it. So that way it accentuates this projection or this cantilevering in both directions, this cross axial direction by the Gale house stacked atop the Roby house. And so from this parterre or this initial idea, he then needs to take and develop this to work through the functional layout of the living spaces with inside the house, the arrangement of the different rooms from this initial massing or form that he's created in this particular orientation on the site with the stream and the hillside. But he also, in addition to that, needs to further work out at this point this interaction with the site as far as the rock outcroppings, how he's going to situate and site this house over the creek and into the hill. I'll also point out, Wright was known for doing a lot of this preliminary design work in his head, not so much on the board or on paper early on in the concepts or the schemes. He would often warn his apprentices that the last thing they wanted to do was to fix a design on paper too early. He would say, one must be able to walk around and inside the structure, know every detail before putting pencil to paper. I never sit down to a drawing board, and this has been a lifelong practice of mine, until I have the whole thing in my mind. I may alter it substantially. I may throw it away. I may find it up a blind alley. But unless I have the idea of the thing pretty well in shape, you won't see me at a drawing board with it. But all the time I have in germinating between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning. So working on it with a triangle and T-square should modify or extend or intensify or test the conception, complete the harmonious adjustments of its parts. And so here we see one of really Wright's strong suits was this really strong, capable ability of visualizing three-dimensional form in his mind's eye. And part of this might be attributed back to his early development with these Froebel blocks that helped him visualize three-dimensional space at a very young age when his mind was developing. But at the same time, nevertheless, it's this ability to work through the house, the shape, but also the arrangement of all of the different rooms within the house, but also all the detailing of the house, of how these parts are going to come together. For example, the horizontal roof planes intersecting with the vertical mass walls, the windows, the doors, all of this stuff. He would work through in his mind before he'd sit down and put, as he said, pencil to paper. And so 1935, September of 1935, later that year after he was out visiting the site, Edgar Coffin was getting anxious to see what kind of design he was coming up for his house. He was out in Milwaukee for a business trip, and so he made a quick trip over to Taliesin, Wright's home and office, to take a look at the work. At the time, it was about a two-hour drive from Milwaukee, and called to let Wright know that he was on his way. Wright welcomed him over, and he sat down and started to put pencil to paper and to flush out some designs and drawings that he could show to Kaufman when he arrived. So we see here one of these perspectives, very much like the model that we just were looking at, where you can see the long horizontal in parallel to the stream below it, as well as the projecting terrace above that in at a 90 degree angle to the Roby extension. And this drawing significantly enough not only portrayed this concept of the house sitting up on the hillside over the stream or over the waterfall, so to speak, but it also illustrates, here I'll show you with two images, this early sketch that he put down in September of 95, or 1935, sorry. And then we see the finished product here, 1938, this is a much later photograph, but the house 3 years later, you can see how close in perspective the two forms are. Flip back and forth here a couple times. To where Wright standing down here on the stones here, from, if you recall back from the July visit to the site when he was looking at the rock outcropping here and the waterfall, and he was envisioning in his mind's eye the house sitting up here on the hillside over the waterfall. He could see all of this in his head, in his mind, even to the point where the perspective that he sits down and he puts together in a matter of an hour or two is drafted as if he was almost drawing it from a photograph. Quite impressive, or a quite amazing demonstration of his visual skill. So this waterfall was something that obviously attracted the Kaufmans to this property. Wright himself was very fond of the waterfall on this particular site, but also waterfalls in general. His Taliesin house that he was living and working from had a waterfall that he put in place, created. And so here we're seeing a Japanese print of a waterfall. And I show this because these today with falling water, in addition to the Roby house and the Gale house being an influence on this design, the Japanese culture in many respects also had great influence on Wright's work, and in particular falling water here today. This print showing here the style of the rendering of the this Japanese print. The waterfall, if you looked at the continuous lines vertically, is rendered very similar to Wright's renderings here. And the way that Wright renders the landscaping, renders the rock outcrops, is very similar to the way that it's handled here by this Japanese print. And so he was, this stylization was something he was trying to capture in his own renderings, his own drawings. But more significantly, this Japanese culture, not just the prints, but also their architecture, which we'll get into here a little bit further on here today, was of influence that we're going to see in Wright's work. Also, one other side note point out is that during this slow period that we'd mentioned earlier from 28 to 35, when his commissions were not flowing, he actually made more money collecting and selling Japanese prints than he did from his architectural commissions. And so he was able to actually make a living in dealing with these prints that he was fond of, that he would collect from Japan and then sell in, over in the States. And by extension, his kind of dealings of these prints was really kind of the opening up of Japanese culture in the United States in that time period. He was one of the major influences to bringing this aesthetic over through these prints that he was selling. So Kaufman, when he was presented with this design that Wright showed him, was not fond of his idea of placing the house up on the hill, overlooking or cantilevering out over the stream. We see a photograph here from one of their summers when they would go to the out to Bear Run, and they would sit in the water, plunging in the water underneath the waterfall. This is this same spot that we see from the renderings, this rock outcropping, the waterfall, the cropping up here on the left, top left. The house would be further up out of frame of this photograph. And I point this out with Taliesin, the house that he lived and worked in Wisconsin. The name of Taliesin, in Wright's words, means a shining brow. Taliesin is built like a brow on the edge of the hill, not on top of the hill, because I believe you should never build on top of anything directly. If you build on top of the hill, you lose the hill. If you build on one side of the top, you have the hill and the eminence that you desire. So here we see him commenting on his own house in Taliesin. He had a similar site with a hill crest, but he didn't build his house and his office at top of this hill. But here we find him placing falling water on top of this rock outcropping, which is pretty ironic in reference to this adage that he has of losing the hill by building on top of it. And so in effect, building on top of the waterfall, on top of the stream, he's losing the stream and the waterfall. And this was actually by design or of intent. By building on top of the waterfall, the house becomes the waterfall, much the same way building on top of a hill, you lose the hill. In his own words, he says that you can hear the waterfall in the design. Falling water is a great blessing, one of the great blessings to be experienced here on earth. I think nothing yet ever equaled the coordination, the sympathetic expression of the great principle of repose, where forest and stream and rock and all the elements of structure are combined so quietly that really you listen not to any noise whatsoever, although the music of the stream is there. But you listen to the falling water the way you listen to the quiet of the countryside. And so here, Wright, knowing Kaufman's family's love for nature, the outdoors, where they would spend their time in leisure, knowing this, he didn't want them to, as you see in this photograph, spend their time wading in the water from their house. He wanted to place the house on top of it, make the house become the waterfall, to where they could become integral part of the waterfall in their daily life in living in the house. And in particular, it's this idea of the sound, listening to the water rushing past down over the side. This would all reverberate through the house. And in particular, by placing the house on top, he denies the ability to see the waterfall, but he is bringing it in through sound. And this is an interesting thing because it's this kind of silencing of the main visual sense to accentuate the audible sense. And so it creates a much more acute awareness of the sounds of the waterfall that they might not have noticed previously when they were out there, and the visual sense is dominant. And so he's taking advantage of this type of immersion in the senses with the design of this house. And one other note of strategy here, I'll point out, if we take an aerial view of falling water, you can see falling water here right at in the falls coming out over the side. And in this particular orientation where he's placed the house on top of this rock outcropping, the main living space of the house, again, this horizontal Roby cantilevering terrace direction here, as well as the bedroom suite above it, are all facing here to the right in the image, which is to the south. You can see it's well lit from the sun, but you can also see with the trees here across the creek that the light, you can see the top of the waterfall is catching some of this sunlight that's getting past the trees here, but then down below at the bottom of the waterfall, it's in the shadow, shaded by these trees on the southern side of the stream. And so had Wright located the house on the opposite side from the vantage point of where these previous photos were taken, which was Kaufman's preference of sighting the house would have then, if it was orientated towards the waterfall from that location, the living spaces within the house would have been on the north side of the house, which is not preferable in a house. Generally speaking, Wright would try to orientate his house, the living spaces to the south, to the sun, so that way you could get the natural daylight into the house, flooding into the living spaces and bring that light into the use of the space. And so there was, in addition to just the dramatics of placing it over the stream, there was also an advantage with the site and with the orientation to the sun in locating it here as well. He also took advantage of, again, going back to this Japanese house that he was fond of, this idea of a borrowed view, this concept in Japanese architecture where the exterior and quite often a distant view on the horizon, placing that in perspective or in view from the garden or from within the house, as we're seeing here in this photograph, is this idea of borrowing that landscape to bring it in and make it part of the visual composition that you're taking in. And so it's this way in Japanese culture of bringing the outdoors into becoming part of the experience of the space. And so this idea was something also that was that Wright was aware of and fond of, trying to bring this concept of design into the space. Also, one other element here of significance in the Japanese house is these sliding screens along the perimeter of the house or perimeter of the room. And so these screens, these walls, were these moving partitions around the entire perimeter of the house. You could slide them apart and open up entire sides of the house to the exterior. And this was something that Wright was also fond of. In addition to this borrowed view, it afforded this ability to open up the interior to the exterior, make it one continuous space. And so here we see in this image with this Japanese house, we see him replicating it here in Falling Water from the main living space. You can see him taking these doors, glass doors, and by opening them up in a similar fashion to the Japanese house, extend the interior space out into the exterior space in the same fashion. Here we can see a view up from the exterior, this same interior space here extending out onto this terrace. This is the same Roby terrace that's extending out with the creek here down below running beneath it. Wright was known to say that the box, getting back to this idea of destroying or deconstructing the box, he said that the box is a fascist symbol. The architecture of freedom, democracy, needed something besides the box. So I set out to destroy the box as a building. With the corner window, light came in where it had never come in before, vision went out, and you had screens instead of walls. Walls vanished as walls and box vanished as a box. corner window was release of the entire sense of structure. And so here we see, if we take a look at the floor plan, this is on the main space here, this the main living room here in the center. Off to the left is this terrace that we were just looking at, the doors that open up to allow this interior space to flow to the exterior. Also in the same direction on the right, the doors over here on the right extend out onto the exterior terrace. So here we see him taking this Japanese house concept and he's bringing it into Falling Water to where the window as well as the corner window extending out to the exterior. And also significantly, I'll point out as we go up to the second floor plan here, the bedroom suites also have the master bedroom here in the center has its own terrace that comes out extending in opposition to the lower terrace. Again, this Gale House cantilever. But then also the bedroom over on the left-hand side, as well as the guest bedroom on the right-hand side. Each one of these have their own terrace. So every interior space extends out to a terrace. If we go up to the top penthouse level, where Kaufman Jr.'s bedroom was, we see the same thing. The bedroom here at the top, as well as his studio study, all of these have this extension out to the terrace. And so this idea of taking the interior space and having it not just connected to the exterior, but physically directly connected to where they were, you could move from one to the other, you could open these doors and have the space continue uninterrupted and extended out to the exterior in this way of trying to eliminate the wall, breaking and destroying this box, so to speak, to where the space flows continuously from interior to exterior. And so here we see an image of this pretty clearly. You can see down again from the library on the main living space, the doors extending out here on the left. Here's this corner window he spoke of. And by bringing this window completely around, much like Corbusier's Villa Savoy ribbon window, continuously wrapping the sides, but by this cantilevering of the ceiling roof plane here, in as well as the floor plane below it, taking the glass from roof ceiling to floor enables this effect to where the wall has now been eliminated by this continuous window and glass door wrapping around around the corner and down along the length of the space. And so it's this this way of him eliminating the walls of the box, so to speak. In particular, there's also this interesting feature in the main living space here. We're seeing this glass half wall structure here that can be opened up and slid back to where it creates this staircase that goes down from the living room directly. Again, this idea of extending the exterior space from the interior in a direct fashion. As you can see here with the door panels, glass panels opened up, the space down below at the bottom of the stairs, which is the stream, Bear Run, is in complete connection. So despite the fact that the house is built atop of the creek to where you can't see it from inside, he's created a staircase to take you down directly to it, to where not only can you see it, you can hear it, you can smell it, you even feel the cool breeze coming off of it that comes up and conditions the space when they open up these glass panels. But you can also take a step down there and you can take in the view from the creek as if you're in the creek, the way that the family would do in their leisure. That was afforded again by the house here built over top of it. So he hasn't denied the use of the creek. In particular, you can see the way he brings the staircase down here. Off to the right, he has a wading pool here where they could go and wade in the water outside of the stream that would flow past it. And then if we go back up onto the terrace, yes. So he owned, yeah, no, I don't think that's coincidental. I think that was the architect was referencing knowing his context of being in Pittsburgh. But to your point on Bear Run, there was quite a few acres that the Kaufmans owned up here. I'll have to look that one up. I'm not too sure the rights of the run itself. Obviously, it crosses over that property, despite the fact they had hundreds of acres. The creek continued through their property, and so I'm not too sure how those land rights were set, but that is a good question as far as being in it. Without question, in today's oh, nice, very. Excellent. Great point. And yes, to that point, builders and architects today, if you do build out over or alongside moving water, there's quite a formal process you go through in having to submit and make sure that you're doing it in a way that doesn't destroy or change the environment. And so I'm sure that that's something that that was a front of mind for Wright, being so connected to the environment as well as Kaufman's as well, being tied to the their love for nature. There's no doubt that I think he was wanting to be respectful of the stream, but as far as the rights in particular, that's a good question. I'll have to do a little research on that one. This one other point I'll make here with these stairs that go down from the terrace above, you can see here at the end the circular portion where it's open to the sky. So standing on the stairs, despite the fact that on the interior there's some glass panels you pull back that close it off from the interior. On the exterior, he's allowing this vertical axis to continue up. From the stream below. Here we see if we step back on the terrace, you can looking back at the house, you can again see this transparency that's created by this continuous window glass wrapping the corners, again eliminating the sense of the wall from the box. Over here on the left in plan, you can see standing out here on the terrace and looking back across these stairs through the living space on the interior and then the terrace on the far end. We get on the right-hand image here, we get the same type of perspective you get standing in the Robie House dining room, looking across the space, down through the space on this continuous axis towards the living room, the same fashion as the Robie House living room, that classic image. But you can see with the doors open, you can see how space flows through the house continuously uninterrupted. And so it's this idea of this uninterrupted continuation was something that was very strong, not only in his earlier plans with the prairie as far as the open floor plan, but more significantly here in Falling Water, where he's trying to create this sense of a completely open box, completely open space. Where the interior is not differentiated from the exterior, kind of a blurring of the envelope. So with that, I'm going to take a quick 5-minute break here. We'll resume back here at 4:01. Picking back up here with from the terrace here at the top of the exterior steps that go down to the stream, you can see this view from the inside here. Again, this continuous space, and this continuous space, in particular on the diagonal, we're seeing again this three-quarter view, not from the exterior, but in this case from the interior. This was this way of, much like the cubist, viewing two sides simultaneously. This afforded the ability to look through the space in a dynamic way visually. This third dimension, in Wright's words, never as weight or as mere thickness, but always as depth, an element of space, the third dimension transformed as a space dimension, a penetration of the inner depths of space in spaciousness, becomes architectural and valid motif in design. With this concept of depth interpenetrating depths comes flowering of freedom in design, which architects have never known before, but which they may now employ in their designs as a true liberation of life and light within the walls. And so here we see this idea where he's, again, he's opening up the space by removing the exterior walls, replacing them with these visual screens, the glass windows, continuous windows and doors. And so this opening up of space, we'll see here as we take a quick tour through the house, from the exterior. We take the approach of the house, again, this view from the bridge, the drive that goes across the stream down below, underneath this bridge. We work our way around. You can see then the stream here running down. We see the cantilevering terrace that we mentioned before, as well as the stairs going down to the stream from the living room. Continue our way around here to the backside of the house, between the house and the hillside. And as we approach and work our way up to it, we can see then the entry to the house here lit up from the interior, tucked back inside to the backside of the house here. And this was significant. This was also a signature of Wright's houses, to where not only is the entry disguised away from the front, but more significantly, this idea of compression of space, compression and then eventually release as well. Here he's taking the wide open spaciousness of the exterior. He's bringing us into the front door here in between these walls. Also of note here, as we pass by the entryway, he's got this little fountain here off on the right-hand side. It's a place for the family to stop and wash their hands or feet coming in from the stream before going into the house. But also, going back to before the break, we talked about hearing the stream and not seeing it. This was one way over by the backside of the house where the stream was not as audible. He could have this water running from this fountain, this trickling, to create, again, this sound experience as you come in through the front door, so that way you hear this running water, referencing again the location of the house with the stream. Here's another view of that from the other side of the wash here. Looking through, you can see the terrace beyond. But then as we come inside the front entryway, again, it's this compressed single door. It brings you inside. But of note, you can see the not only is it compressed here at the entryway, opening up into the main living space, but also he's the modulation of the light as well. You can see at the far end of the image the brightness from the light flooding in through these through the windows and doors, continuous without the wall on the far side. But here the entryway is quite dark, because of the massing of these stone walls, squeezing you, compressing you as you pass through the front threshold. As we work our way further in, again, we come past the music sitting area here on the left, the library straight ahead, that we saw previously. Again, you can see the light modulating from washing in here, again, facing the southern exposure. But then as it crosses the floor towards the entry, you can see the light dimming. And so it's this handling of this light drawing you across the room towards the windows on the southern side, towards the stream. This is a visual effect that is much the same way that if you were the Kaufmans working your way through the forest around the stream here, through the thickets and the trees, the rhododendrons. As you can imagine, you're compressed and you're squeezing through the, as you work your way through the forest, trying to find a clearing. And much like these clearings on the rock outcroppings near the stream or down at the base, below the falls, you naturally are drawn instinctively towards these clearings just to kind of get a little bit of a release or relief from this compression in the thickets of the forest. And so he's replicating the same type of sensation as you work through the house and come through the entryway. And by doing so, the light, the open expanse of the main living space is drawing you across it and out towards, again, these exterior terraces that overlook the water below. So as we then arrive at the main living room here, you can see in three dimensions, in three directions, the house opens up to the exterior. This was an effect, if you recall back from last week's lecture with Corbusier's Villa Savoy, his ribbon window that wraps the house. Similar effect that he was trying to achieve, this panoramic view, vista, that it creates. Also of note, if we step back in here to the living room briefly, one of my clients actually just visited Falling Water this past weekend, and before they left, I asked them to send me some notes as to their impressions of the house. My client has two young daughters that had, I don't believe, had been to the house before. But one of their daughters, Audrey, wrote some notes on her experience from going through the house. And I want to mention where she had said one of the things she really liked was the brown-orange color all over the house. She said it felt really natural and wooden. And so here we can see this color colorization that Wright is using within the house. To a very strong effect. This orange and brown that Audrey mentions, you can see is brought through the house here, not only in the walnut, the wood that, that you can see encased on the ceiling, but also in the furniture that Wright designed, the cushions here, but also significantly, probably the most significant color in the house are the is the concrete, the walls of the terrace in this ochre color that he created. And a little side note here, at the time that they were building this house, Wright suggested to Kaufman that he had the concrete walls in the forms of the house be gold leafed. As you can see in the image here, he's got the stone walls. The stone here is a sandstone, as well as the flagstone on the floor, natural materials. But the concrete was an element that wasn't found naturally in the environment. And so he thought it was an opportunity to accentuate that with a gold leaf. And a gold leaf is significant because that's also a color and a material that was used by the Japanese houses to as a way to bring light into the dark recesses of the space, gold being such a reflective material. And so Kaufman took him up on it. He hired a leafer to come out, and the leafer actually spent a day trying to apply gold leaf to the concrete, But then at the end of the day, he said it was an absurd idea and he left, never to come back. And so they ended up using this ochre color to paint the concrete. And the ochre actually being a color that was very similar to the rhododendrons in the environment as they changed in the fall to this lighter hue. So we continue through here. We can see the other prominent color that he used here was his Cherokee red, which was a color that Wright used through quite a bit of his works, in particular on the metalwork here, not only in the kettle and in the fireplace, but also the frames of the windows and doors. Closer look here at some of the furnishings. As we work our way through the main living room space here, and in particular the fireplace, this is the stones here from the outcroppings. He cited the house to place the top of that outcropping at the top of the waterfall. These stones that were spots that the Kaufmans would sit and picnic before the house was built, when they would sit on top of the waterfall. There was also some lore or legend that these stones were also used by George Washington when he came through the area back in the 1700s, and might have actually sat at the top of the same waterfall stone outcropping as well for his encampment. You could see this large kettle that swings around into the fireplace for warming and brewing drinks. The dining table, interesting point out here, the chair here is a chair that was found by Mrs. Kaufman over in Europe, but it, in particular, it was a three-legged chair in order to be able to sit securely on an uneven floor of the flagstone. Three legs being a very stable position. The kitchen here, you can see the cabinetry also was not Wright's cabinetry, but was a cabinet line, a kitchen line that was brought in. And this brings us back here real briefly here to Corbusier and his Villa Savoy of last week. If you recall back his 5 points towards a new architecture that he was proposing, this is 1928 with his Villa Savoy. He was this idea of these pilotis, if you recall back, where he's raising the living space up off of the ground by these columns or these pillars. And by doing this, he frees up the space below the house, as well as the garden on top, which was one of his second point of architecture. So he's doubled the real estate of usable exterior space, despite the fact he's built his house on this plot. This also, these columns or pilotis afforded him the open floor plan. We see here with his partie for this concept, the domino idea of these pilotis holding the roof and the floor slabs. So again, it enables the structure to freestand without the exterior walls. So there, in effect, he can not only have the floor itself be open without interior partitions to have to support the walls or the floors in the roof above, but also then the exterior wall afforded the ability to also be a free facade with the continuous ribbon window, since the exterior wall is not a bearing wall. So these 5 points of Corbusier's architecture we see here in Falling Water, taken even further by Wright. If you recall back to his quote at the beginning of the lecture, where he stood and envisioned this house that would take these European modernists or internationalists and take their ideas even further. And so here we see him with Falling Water. Not only does he have the interior free plan of Corbusier, or in Wright's words, the open floor plan, to where the space flows continuously uninterrupted. But he's eliminated the columns, the pilotis that Corbusier needed for his open plan. He also, on the exterior, you can see this stacking of these floors without the columns again. But he's done this with these terraces that cantilever out from each individual room. He's also done one better on Corbusier's rooftop garden, where Corbusier had doubled his real estate with the space below as well as the space on top. With all of these terraces, Wright has in fact created four a quadrupling of the real estate at each level with these terraces. The same with the, again, the corner window is kind of taking his ribbon window concept even further, where it wraps the corner to where it's continuous. So his wall is completely void. Again, he's eliminated the wall from his box. But also in reference to Corbusier's free facade or free wall, he's taken it away altogether. And so he's not only extended these 5 points, but he's also redefined the structure. And so the question that we might have here, see also some examples of this, the corner windows that open up, enable the space, much like the doors, to flow uninterrupted at the corners. And if we also go back inside, take a quick look upstairs. He does the same thing at the far end here, the staircase that takes you up to the bedroom levels. He does a similar thing with the compression up this tight, narrow staircase that then releases into the bedroom. And you can see creates the shadow again and the light that draws you out onto the terrace, this being the main bedroom for the Kaufmans. You can see a fireplace as well in the stacked above the fireplace below, the corner desk, and the corner window as well, that without the mullion in the corner, that enables the space to flow visually as well as physically inside the bathroom vanity. Take note real briefly here, the plant planter here against the windowsill to bring this continuous plant along the edge of the vanity. And then the view of, out on the terrace, looking back at the bedroom suite. Again, the window, the continuous window from floor to ceiling, eliminating the wall. And then also we'll take a quick brief trip up to the guest house. We can see his use of stone and concrete again. In particular, the cover for the stairs leading up to the guest house, this cantilevering shape that folds up one continuous ribbon that, but also is only supported on the one side by these columns, steel columns. And so the dramatics or the acrobatics that he goes through cantilevering this concrete ribbon. As you can see here, very dramatically from the guest house up above, looking back down at falling water here below, you can see how it's supported just by individual columns on the outside here. And so this cantilevering here, not only in the house terraces proper, but here he's also taking it and really showcasing it as you go up to the guest house, what he's been able to do with concrete. And this was his first use of reinforced concrete in a built structure, and so he's really taking it and playing with it. And I'll play here a quick segment where he's being asked. So he's pointing out here the previous traditional form of architectural construction. If we go back, sorry, the audio is not working here, to where the this idea of the organic architecture that he's proposing here in Falling Water, to where the structure is continuous, integral, and works as a cohesive whole, as opposed to the post and beam type structure that we would find in traditional form of construction prior to this new material of reinforced concrete that he's using here in Falling Water. And so from this, if we take a look at how this is, he's able to achieve these dramatics with the cantilevering, to where he's able to suspend these floors and roof without these columns, so to speak, in the space, these great expanses. We see here, again, from the drive coming up the approach to the house, you can see here the hillside on the right-hand side that's coming down to the stream Bear Run on the left, the lower left. And so this outcropping here on the right-hand side, the hillside, he's going to excavate into it to make level for his drive, as well as to create a foundation for him to build upon to extend the cantilever out on the left. And so if we take a diagram here, you can see in section, you can see in brown here is the earth or the ground plane, the sloping hillside coming down to the stream in blue here at the bottom on the left. We takes cuts into this hillside again for the drive, the main living floor of the house. He's built this in gray here, these four foundation piers that is going to support these beams that he places on top of them. This is the concrete beam structure here that he brings across and ties back into the hillside here on the right. But then he cantilevers it out 15 feet beyond the support on the left. And this is what enables him to get his cantilevering out over the stream. If we take a look at here in a perspective drawing from above, you can see these four piers, three of them in concrete, the fourth one here on the left in stone that he's used laying up his sandstone. And then on top of those four piers, he has his beams. And you can see the beams continuous running across here that are creating the beams for his floor that support. And then from those beams between them, he has additional joist beams, narrow, smaller concrete infill between them running perpendicular to tie back between them. And then from this grid that he's creating of this of these concrete beams, he then attaches his slab, concrete slab, to the underside. Another rendering here that you can see, in addition to the concrete structure and slab that creates his floor, on top of these horizontal lateral beams, he lays wood planks that then become the support for the flagstone that becomes the floor within the space. This terrace that we looked at earlier with the staircase that goes down to the stream, you can see in order to afford this opening, this vertical axis that he brings up for the staircase, this one beam that's cantilevering out makes a turn. It curves around this opening and continues out. Here again, you can see the horizontals, the smaller beams running perpendicular to the larger cantilevering beams. Again, all of this creating the structure that then the concrete slab fills in between. So if we go back to our diagram, once he has the first floor slab in place, he places these columns, steel columns here, out at the far end of his support below. And that then receives his second floor, bedroom floor cantilever. And this is the, again, the Gale House cantilever that's going in the opposing direction to the Roby direction cantilever down below. This post at the far point enables him to support the structure here that's cantilevering out even further to the left than the lower cantilever of the main living space. And so we see in this diagram here on the right-hand side, he's taking this back and he's tying it into the hillside. We can see here with some of these photographs that these beam structures that are going back, tying into the hillside to tie his structure off and ground it, so to speak, into the rocks for the tensile strength. And then next, after we move up another series of columns to support, again, a fourth or a third deck up, which would be the penthouse suite for Junior's bedroom. He then has a series of columns as well. And then finally, the roof structure supported on top of that. So we have a layering of four slabs that are supported as you work your way up. And we see here, you can see some of the dynamics. You can see the beams here coming through, again, in series. He's tied these into the rock face very dramatically here. But then these also carry back through to support this terrace that's cantilevering out. You can see here, again, another image in construction. You can see the terrace itself, these beams continuing through from the rock face out. And so the terrace is being supported or tied back in to the rocks for its support. Here's a few images from construction. The stonemasons shaping the sandstone to lay the walls that are supporting these slabs. Some of the support structure as they're putting the concrete forms in place for the slabs cantilevering themselves. You can also see down below, you can see these four piers, structural piers in concrete. Here's the opening again for the staircase that comes down to the creek. You can see the steel stubbed out from the concrete that's going to receive the bars that support the stair treads. Yes. Now they worked right through it. Yes, I used what Wright referred to as a gravity heat. Which was a radiant heat system. The water is heated and then radiated through the space that was built in. I wanted to point out also of note here, this water, speaking of heat and the absence of heat, one of the largest problems of building a house over a stream is that you have water to contend with, not only the stream itself, but all of the water that's flowing down the hillside into the stream, that's gathering in the stream. All of this flow is wanting to work its way through the house, around the house, down alongside the house. And so this is water is not only the single biggest thing to contend with in architecture from a design standpoint, to help the house stand and weather the climate or the elements. But in particular, falling water is tasked with this being built out over a stream and really being in the face of water directly. And so we see the effects of this on the structure itself. You can see, I'll read you here a passage from Wright himself describing this. He said, "The rounded tops of the concrete terrace," we're seeing here the wall terrace walls for the steps that go up from the from Edgar's terrace up to the Junior's suite on the top floor. The rounded top of the concrete terrace walls was added only after the reinforcing walls had set a few days, not long enough. And so they didn't have a strong seal. And so over the years, these so-called wall caps or surfacing separated from the walls, structural walls themselves. And that separation allows water to get in, or in this case, the acid rain seeping in. And this water and acid rain works its way through the concrete to the steel reinforcing within the concrete. And as you can imagine, it causes that steel to corrode, rust, especially through the freeze-thaw cycle of the seasons. As it freezes, the water expands, causes the concrete to fracture and break off. And so this is something that requires some repair. And over the years, it's taken on quite an amount of this abuse from the elements and needed some upkeep. And so actually in 2001, it underwent a 2-year renovation, pretty sizable and extensive, to repair most of the damage from the water. But in particular, more so than some of the superficial damage that we just saw in the last photograph, but specifically the cantilevering beams, the concrete, made of concrete, was also vulnerable to the same effects. And as a result, needed to be strengthened. In this case, they decided to use what's referred to as a post-tension cable, where they bring in, you can see here, the steel rebar that generally would be encased within the concrete beams. This here, they're bringing them alongside the beams, and then they would bring them tight, and they would plug these holes, and then they would use a machine to pull these cables, stretch them out, create a tension built into the steel. And so you can see from some images on the interior, you can see here, once they took the floor up during these renovation repairs, pulled all of the flagstone up to get to the concrete beam here, cantilevering out, you can see it. You can actually see a slight bow in the beam. You can see where it's sagging. That was part of the problem, was that the cantilevers as a result of this were sagging. This tensioning of the cables they ran alongside of the beams enabled it to put some tension into the beam. It can straighten these out to where the sagging could be stopped from continuing to sag and move. And so with that, a few minutes over, we can open it up here to any questions. In the interim, I'll read a quick quote here. I'm going to go back. Because we were running short on time, I skipped over this, but significant point I'd like to make here. Work our way back to the interior. This idea of spaciousness, that interior space, as if you recall back as you go into the entry, work our way into the main space. I'll read from Wright's words. He says, "This new sense of spaciousness requires an inherent human factor, significant cover as well as shade. Solidity of walls vanishing to reappear as imaginative screens involving light, and as an inevitable consequence, leaving more responsibility to the shapes and the shaping of the whole building overhead, with a direct reference to the elements." So here he's pointing out this idea that one of the consequences of removing the exterior walls, replacing them with these screens, glass screens, is that you bring in much more light to the space, But then in addition to flooding the space with light, you also create less of a sense of enclosure. Again, this was something he was trying to create, was this feeling that the interior flows seamlessly with the exterior. But the job of a structure or a building to create a sense of shelter is being questioned here or lost by the enclosure evaporating away. And so in order to maintain a certain sense of comfort or safety, feeling of sheltering within the space without the typical walls or box that you have was a new challenge that this new form of architecture has to confront. And in his mind, this shading, when you go back into the darker recesses, in this case, like at the entry, by modulating the light, you can create this this effect, almost like a cave, to where you can burrow back into the darker recesses of the room and create some of that environment where you feel a sense of security or safety that's not afforded out in the exposed side of the room. And so I thought that it's interesting in that not only is he proposing this new organic form of architecture, but he's also recognizing how this is changing our perceptions of the space as a result of this new type of architecture that these new materials like concrete and steel are offering with this cantilevering and this acrobatics that he's doing structurally. So with that, we'll leave it here for today, and we'll pick up next week with Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth House. Thank you.